So we already had a nice introduction about the life cycle of gas and dust. So I always show this picture, and usually it's not very relevant, I just show it. But in this meeting it's actually quite relevant, so I might as well show it again. So basically, we're going to talk about mostly massive stars that are usually found in young massive clusters like this. And of course you have a whole IMF, so you also have low mass stars in here. But it's the ionizing radiation of the massive stars that is very relevant for influencing star formation outside. We have these nice pillars of creation. And if you have a good look at the next speaker, you will see some nice other examples. Of course, it's the winds of these stars that we're also interested in. So you can have winds in these clusters, important for enrichment of globular clusters. And then here we also have an example of SHOR25, which is an evolved blue supergiant, and you can clearly see it has made a very nice shell around the star. So we basically have a lot of the topics in this meeting already in this first picture. But what I'm going to talk about is the inner wind, the launching of the winds from the photosphere to the terminal velocity. So I'll first give an introduction about different stellar winds we can think of. And most of the talk will be about hot star winds, so O-star winds, and not just normal O-stars, but also super O-stars, or O-stars on steroids. These are very massive stars, up to 300 solar masses, and they have Wolf-Rayet-type spectra. Then we go to evolved massive star winds. These are luminous blue variables and classical Wolf-Rayet stars, and something about supernovae as well. So what type of stellar winds do we have from the observations? We can have solar-type winds, where the terminal velocity of the wind is quite comparable to the escape speed. These winds have very low mass loss rates, 10 to the minus 14 solar masses per year. Now, that is much, much smaller than the life of the solar mass divided by the lifetime of the sun. So for stellar evolution, the solar wind is not important. Of course, it's very important for the interaction of the wind with the Earth's atmosphere. But this becomes very different, of course, for the winds when the sun becomes an evolved star, red giant, and also for massive star, for red supergiants. But here we have high mass loss rates, up to 10 to the minus 4 solar masses per year, but they're very low terminal velocities, much smaller than the escape velocity. Now, the escape velocity is also much smaller, of course. But for hot star winds, we have also high mass loss rates, but here the wind velocities are very high. They can be up to 3 times the escape velocity, so we can have 2,000-3,000 kilometers per second. And for Wolf-Rayet stars, even 5,000-6,000 kilometers per second. Not only important for stellar evolution, just like here, but because of these high velocities, the kinetic energy input, which goes with the velocity squared, suddenly becomes very, very significant. So we need to understand the winds of massive stars to understand the input of kinetic wind energy. The other point, of course, is that we need to know the ionizing radiation. And to get the correct ionizing radiation, you need the correct effective temperatures. And to get the right temperatures, it turns out you need to have good model atmospheres with just a photosphere and a wind, and you need modified stellar atmospheres, and we will hear about that in the next talk, where it turns out that the wind contribution is actually very important to get the correct stellar parameters. So lots of reasons to study winds. What are the mechanisms? In the case of the solar wind, it's a gas pressure gradient that drives the wind. And the way you can do that is because the sun has a very hot corona, and the gas pressure gradient can drive a wind. Now, for the sun, it gets a bit more complicated, because then the question is also, how do you get such a hot corona? You probably need magnetic fields. But the basic principle of the Parker wind works really well for the sun. You can have wave pressure gradients, and you can have radiation pressure gradients. And the radiation pressure can act on dust, for instance, for cool supergiants, or it can act on electrons for hot stars, and also on line opacity. And that turns out to be the most important aspect for O-star winds. So if you have the basic momentum equation, you basically have an inertia term, gravity, and the gas pressure gradient. And of course, you have the mass continuity equation. And if you fill that in, you get a formula like this. And the interesting point of the Parker wind is that this explodes, this equation explodes when the velocity equals the sound speed. A is the sound speed. So when V equals A, this goes to zero. So you suddenly divide your V VDR, this term, you have to divide that by zero. You can't do that, so you get a singularity, a critical point. And the solar wind is driven from the photosphere through the sonic point up to high terminal velocities. And the same can be applied to other stellar winds. Now, in relative, of course, winds are not isothermal. They expand, so you need to get into account correctly. Now, other stellar winds can also be represented by this formula. You just add another acceleration. And this can be anything you want. You can put in magnetic fields, you can put in radiative pressure, whatever you want. Now, in the case of hot star winds, that is the radiative acceleration is the most important. And the radiative acceleration is just the flux times the opacity. And if you write the flux over, say, L over 4 pi r squared, you get this nice equation. And if you just have electron scattering here, you can already have a significant radiative acceleration. But that basically just means you have a lower effective mass. To actually drive a stellar wind, you also need the lines. And those lines can be hydrogen, helium, CNO. Everything needs to be included. Of all the different ionization stages, iron 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, etc., all the way. And in different parts of the wind, you can have different driving. And the basic way is you absorb a photon, and then the subsequent re-emission is more or less isotropic, so you get a net outward acceleration. And it turns out that iron is the most important line driver. And then you can derive mass loss rate recipes, like the mass loss rate depends on the luminosity. The more photons you have, the easier it is to escape the star. Lower the mass, have a lower potential well, you can escape the wind. The effective temperature sets the ionization stratification. So that determines, therefore, the opacity. That is very relevant. And also, the metallicity sets the opacity. If you go to lower metallicity environments, you have less opacity, you have a lower mass loss rate. OK, why is iron so important? Because for every iron atom in the galaxy, you have 2,500 hydrogen atoms. So why is hydrogen not more important? It's because hydrogen is a very simple atomic structure. This is the Grotrian diagram for hydrogen. This is for iron 5, just a few lines indicated. If you look at all the iron lines, this is completely black. There are millions of lines, millions. So iron dominates the line driving. Looking at the wind dynamics, we need to investigate what this radiative acceleration looks like. So it's actually quite a simple formula, but it gets difficult because this one is difficult. And you will find out you get a velocity at the surface of zero, and you reach a terminal velocity over there. You can represent this by a beta law. Oh. Now, the most famous hot star wind analysis is that by Kastor, Abbott, and Klein, and therefore we have the CAK wind theory. The way they have represented the line acceleration is using electron scattering as a basic acceleration mechanism times a certain force multiplier. You boost the mass loss rate by a certain factor because you have all these Doppler shifted lines in the accelerating wind. And you can represent that with two parameters, a K, which is something about the strength. So at lower metallicity, K is lower. And then alpha. And alpha is just a representation of how many optically thin lines you have in comparison to optically thick lines. And this is just the optical depth parameter. So this is one way of representing it. And this was very powerful, but we now know that these K and alphas are no longer constant. But I'll come back to that. But in principle, this works really well. So you can just plug that into your equation of motion. So here, your G-rad has now been represented by this K and alpha. And now you have a velocity gradient in your equation of motion, not just the Newtonian velocity gradient, but also a Sobolev velocity gradient. If you say that these are the same, then you can find a new critical point, which is the CAK critical point, which is further down the wind. But is this physical? That is still a question that is maybe not, there's no consensus about that. But if you do this game and you solve this equation of motion, you can derive that the terminal wind velocity is just a function of alpha. And for O-stars, this alpha parameter, which just means how many optically thin lines you have, is about 2/3, and therefore this ratio is about 3. And then if you go to lower temperatures, then alpha will drop, so you get different ratios of V infinity over V escape. So the reason in the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram you go from fast winds to cool winds is partly because the escape velocity drops, but it's partly also because alpha drops. Yeah? So not just the escape velocity. It's also atomic physics. And then the mass loss rate is a more complicated formula. Don't worry about it. There's a mass dependence in here, but because alpha is about 2/3, if you multiply the mass loss rate and the velocity, you get the momentum of the wind. And because for O stars, the mass dependence cancels, you get a very nice relation between the two. And this has been looked at by Rolf Kudrytsky. If you plot the wind momentum versus the luminosity, you get very nice relations. And potentially, you can derive even distances from stars, because if you get the velocity and the mass loss rate from the spectrum, you get something over here, and then boom, you find your luminosity. So this can be used as an extragalactic distance scale indicator, because these massive stars are very bright, so you can see them out to far distances. But it's also very important to use as a tool to determine if there's a mass loss metallicity dependence. If you didn't have this relationship, it would be very hard to compare, say, an O star in the galaxy to an O star in the SMC, because the parameters will not be the same. The mass loss rate does not just depend on metallicity, it also depends on the mass, the luminosity, the effective temperature. So to find two stars with exactly the same parameters is very hard. But because of this relation, you can just plot all the empirical relations over here. So the solid lines are empirical relations, the dotted dashed lines are theoretical relations, and both give a similar offset if you go between the Milky Way, the LMC, and the SMC. So there is a mass loss metallicity dependence. Now, if you have good eyes, you can see there is also an offset between empirical rates and observations. Yeah? We'll come back to that. Most people will think if you have an observational law and a theoretical one, the theoretical one will be wrong. In this case, most people think it's the other way around. It's the observations that are wrong. And it's not actually the observations that are wrong. Observations don't lie. But the way that you interpret the observations. And that's because of clumping. The winds are clumped, and therefore the empirical rates are overestimated. Oh, so there's something else going on in hot star winds. If you believe the CAK theory and the strong dependence on the velocity gradient, the VDR, then you have an interesting situation that the line acceleration depends on the velocity gradient. The velocity gradient depends on the acceleration. So if you have just a little bit too much momentum into the wind, you basically get a higher acceleration and therefore, again, a higher velocity gradient, so you get an instability, you get a runaway effect, and that is called the line-driven instability. And if you plot this in hydro simulations, then you will find that the velocity law is no longer a nice CAK, but you have all these shocks in the wind. And the density will show something similar, because you still have mass continuity, so the density will also show these interesting bumps and wiggles. And the interesting point is that the mass loss rate expected from a wind like this is exactly the same as for a smooth wind. The mass loss rate is expected to be preserved. Yeah? But because the densities are showing bumps and wiggles, you expect the winds to be clumped. So you expect the diagnostics to be affected. Okay, so there's lots of evidence for structured winds. So if you want to derive correct empirical mass loss rates, you need to get the unclumped ones, the old ones, and divide it by the square root of the clumping factor. This needs to be done if you have a density, a mass loss diagnostic that depends on the density squared. For instance, radio emission or H-alpha line emission. Because those are recombination. The hydrogen line, H-alpha, is mostly a nice emission line, and therefore it's a recombination line, and that means that it goes to the density squared. That's why you get a square root in there. Now, I keep saying if the CAK theory is right, so let's go back and say, well, actually, is that the only way we can look at this problem? Let's ignore the gas pressure, because in most of the wind, that's not relevant. Only below the sonic point is important. You can indeed reproduce this radiative acceleration. You can parameterize that as a function of dVdr. But these days we know that is only relevant in the outer rim for optically thick lines, for strong lines. But most of the driving is done by iron lines very close to the surface, which are optically thin. Yeah. So even though in the spectrum you see these very strong lines of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, they are not important for driving, or not really important. What's really important is all the tiny little iron lines. So there's no fundamental reason why you need to parameterize this as a function of the velocity gradient. You can also just parameterize it as a function of radius, and then get your correct model and just iterate. What is important is that you include multiple scatterings, and there's a couple of different ways of doing that. One way is using Monte Carlo. You emit photons from the stellar surface, and you scatter them in the wind. And you just need to make sure that the conditions in all these shells are correct. So you have the right temperature, the right ionization stratification, so that you have the right thermal pool, so that you can allow photons to be absorbed and also scattered. And what you can then find is that the total wind momentum per second, m dot v infinity, can be higher than the photon, than the momentum from the radiation field, the photon momentum. And you can do that by a factor of 2 or 3. So what happens if we do parameterize the line acceleration as a function of just radius? We can fit that. So the dots are the results of Monte Carlo calculations. And here we have the fit. And we can then iterate. So you start with a certain low mass loss rate, 10 to the minus 7 solar masses per year. And you just make sure that you have the right physics in your model. And then you can iterate, and you iterate to the right value, in this case, 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per year. So we can now predict not just mass loss rates, but also wind velocities. This is an example of a mass loss rate. If the physics of the line driving on the DVDR isn't all dominant for the general line driving, how relevant is it for the clumping? We think that the clumps are caused by the line-driven instability, or at least that has been the leading theory for the last 30 years or so. But there is an alternative. If you look at a star, a massive star has a convective core and a radiative outer layer, but that's not the whole story. Very close to the surface, you have an iron opacity bump, and that causes subphotospheric convection. And it is possible that this subsurface convection layer causes density and velocity fluctuations at the surface, already producing clumps, not far out in the wind at half the terminal velocity, but already at very low velocities. And these calculations need to be much better, of course. At the moment, it's just a cartoon. But this might be an idea of actually how to form clumps. And there's a lot of observational evidence that clumping already starts at the surface of stars, not just further out. I mentioned clumping a few times, and there have been discussions that the winds of hot stars are overestimated. And the reason why that became so popular is because of this problem, called the phosphorus 5 problem, that if you look at phosphorus 5 in the ultraviolet, that there's a big discrepancy between your model and your observations if you include smooth winds. And the only way to solve that is either you say the phosphorus 5 ionization is wrong, or the phosphorus abundance is wrong, and none of that seems likely, so therefore it seemed more likely that the mass loss rates were reduced. And not just by a factor 2 to 3, what we think from the optical, but by a factor of maybe 10 or more. But in those analyses in 2006, what wasn't taken into account is porosity. You can have two winds with exactly the same clumping factor. These situations are exactly the same in terms of the clumping factor. Doesn't mean that clumps are cubes, by the way. But it may give you the idea. This star, of course, have less. This wind has more porosity than this one. That one, and what is relevant is the distance between the clumps. If you have a high porosity, the photons might just escape through the clumps and never interact with the matter, and therefore, a lot of material might actually be sneaking out whilst you are not noticing it. And this was solved. This problem, this phosphorus 5 problem, was solved by Oskinova. If you include this porosity in the formal solution, then you can reproduce both the H-alpha line and the phosphorus 5 line without reducing your mass loss rates, at least not by huge factors of 10. Okay, so more recent results from the VLT flames tarantula survey, if you have the wind momentum versus luminosity, the empirical rates are higher than the theoretical rates, and if your clumping factor is about 6 to 8, you reduce the empirical rates by factor 3 and you get in agreement with the theoretical rates. So only if there's extreme clumping, the mass loss rates would need to be reduced. It seems unlikely. Now these super O stars, you need to know what is gamma. To know what is gamma, you need to have this radiative acceleration that goes with 1 over r squared, balance it against gravity, and you get something that just depends on L over m. The radius has cancelled, and therefore this gamma becomes like a stellar parameter, and it's very convenient to look in terms of what happens at high gamma. If you have eta, the wind efficiency, now versus very high gamma, you see that you can get eta values that cross unity. And that means that the mass loss rates are suddenly much steeper. For O stars, 20 to 50 solar mass stars, you have a shallow slope, which is consistent with CAK theory. But if you go above a certain kink, where the winds become optically thick, also the wind efficiency becomes larger than unity, and you get these super O stars. These are Wolf-Rayet stars with hydrogen. So they're just O stars, basically, but they're very dense winds. We can use that at the kink. We know that eta needs to cross unity. Yeah, so we can actually just immediately say that the mass loss rate just depends on this simple formula. The speed of light we know, the terminal velocity we can measure from the UV, and the luminosity we can derive from model atmospheres. This is the most accurate mass loss rates, I think, in any star. We have observed stars for 50 years, we have made models, we have made observations, but this is the most accurate mass loss rate there is, because it is exact. Okay, so can we test this? We can look at large samples of stars, like the VLT flames tarantula survey. In Armagh, we looked at the most massive objects. And what we see, that indeed, if you plot m dot versus gamma, you have your normal slope for CAK winds, O star winds, and then above this kink, we get a much steeper slope, where the slope is 5, in agreement with Monte Carlo calculations. So none of this is included in stellar evolution yet for the most massive stars, so a lot will change when we start including that. So we have looked at stars on the ZAMS, normal O stars and super O stars, but what about the evolved massive stars? We can have LBVs, we can have Wolf-Rayet stars, classical Wolf-Rayet stars, helium burners will be covered in the next talk. I'll talk a bit about LBVs. And LBVs, they change their radii. And why does that happen? It might happen, it is very likely to happen, because the star inflates. If you look below the surface of a star, you have an opacity bump. And if you plot the radiative pressure against the gas pressure, a normal solution, you would want to go from the inside to the outside, but you can't really do that because of this opacity bump. It's in the middle. Yeah. Now, this can also cause pulsations and so on in other types of stars, but for the most massive stars, if convection is inefficient and you don't become convective, the only way to go around this opacity bump and not cross the Eddington limit is to inflate the star. And you can even derive an analytical expression for this inflation, just in terms of a W parameter. So the outer radius of the inner radius is given by this. And it just depends on the properties of that, the width of that iron opacity peak, delta P rad, divided by the density on top of that peak, divided by the potential energy. Yeah, so this is relevant for LBVs. LBVs vary their radii on timescales of 10 years, and they cross changes in the opacity. Here you have fast winds, but if you cross this, you get a slower wind. And you can actually do that again. This is called the bistability jump. This is the second bistability jump. So it's not just that the V escape drops when you go to cooler stars. V infinity over V escape drops from here to here to here. And it keeps happening. And it might even happen further down. So you get changes in the mass loss rate, because iron 4 goes to iron 3, and at the second jump you go to iron 2. You get fast winds, slow winds, but then the mass loss rate keeps going up. A lot of people think that hot star winds have the highest mass loss rates because they're the hottest, but that's wrong. Yes, generally the mass loss rate drops with temperature, but for constant luminosity, but every time you encounter a new iron opacity bump, the mass rate keeps going up. And that is relevant for things like supernova. If you look at radio supernova and you look at the observations over a power law fit, then you see these modulations in the radio light curves, and they may well be due to the LBV phenomenon. And with respect to supernova, people used to do photometry of supernova to look at progenitors, but we can now do spectroscopy. Galliam et al. Had a recent flash spectroscopy, and they found these Wolverine-like features. They thought it was a Wolverine wind, but actually, these winds are very slow. The lines are very narrow, so the winds are very slow. So it's much more characteristic of an LBV or a yellow hypergiant or even a post-red supergiant. For all these objects, LBVs, yellow hypergiants, post-red supergiants, they're all very close to the Eddington limit. And if you look at stellar evolution calculations in the last thousands of years before dying, what you see, here we have 10,000 years before dying, the gamma E factor suddenly increases. And this coincides, the observations, what we see, coincides with this increase in the Eddington limit, which agrees with our calculations that the mass rates go up very, very rapidly. So basically, the super wind. Yeah. One of the things I'm wondering about in this meeting, could some of this also be relevant for cool stars, for red supergiants, but maybe even for AGB stars, where you also have super winds? Could that not be to similar effects? Because there, the luminosities are significant, but the masses are much lower. So just to summarize, the mass rate is a function of the basic stellar parameters, and you have to really look at all of them. You can't just look at one. And the mass rate is a function of gamma, is most relevant for very massive stars, but already on the main sequence, but for normal massive stars in the evolved phases, as a Wolverine, an LBV, and also for supernovae. The temperature dependence is very important for LBV supernova connections, and the metallicity dependence is relevant for gamma ray bursts, superluminous supernova that can only be seen at low metallicity. And the detection of the black holes with the gravitational waves, we also think that those very massive black holes were only very massive because of the low metallicity. So in order to understand feedback, both the ionization and the wind feedback, we need to look at all of this as a function of metallicity. Thank you.
Thank you, Jorik. Questions? I know it's shyness in the beginning. Sophia.
So you said something about how this process could be important also for the AGB superwind.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. That's what I'm trying to learn this week.
But that was really quick, so could you expand a little bit on that, please?
Well, I just wonder, what do the stellar evolution models for low-mass star look like in the last, I don't know, whenever phases of their life? Does your Eddington limit really go up so steeply as well there as it is for hot stars, for massive stars? It's more a question to you than you ask me. I mean, the point is, my understanding is that the cool star wind people think that you get a higher mass loss rate because your luminosity goes up. So the radiation pressure on dust goes up. But for hot star winds, we now know the luminosity is not the relevant parameter. It's gamma. It's the Eddington parameter that's relevant, not the luminosity.
No.
Okay. But it's clear that observations tell us that the higher mass loss rates for the higher luminosity stars. But is it really luminosity? My question is it really luminosity or is it gamma?
I think it's based in luminosity, but I don't know if it has been looked at gamma.
Yeah, but is it? Yeah, I know it's been assumed. It was assumed for hot stars as well, but it was wrong. So.
Another effect that you did not mention is the stellar rotation that can play an important role, because in some cases the radiative flux can depend on the stellar collatitudes.
Yes,
so
sure.
When you measure the mass loss, you have to integrate.
Absolutely. I didn't have time to talk about rotation. I would have loved to talk about rotation. I think for normal O stars, actually, most O stars, yes, they're rapid rotators compared to the Sun, but they're not anywhere near critical. So it's probably a second order effect for most stars. And not for BE stars, not for B bracket E supergiants, not for certain LBVs. There it becomes very important what the rotation is. I also didn't talk about magnetic fields, and the reason I didn't talk about magnetic fields is because only 5% of O stars are magnetic. So for 95% of the stars, it doesn't seem to be the dominant factor. It doesn't mean they're not there, and it doesn't mean anything, but that's just what we know right now.
More questions? Yep.
So another thing that I don't think you mentioned is the weak winds that are being observed around main sequence stars of late type O stars. I was just wondering what your thoughts about on that. What do you think?
Yeah. So first, 10 years ago, I thought the problem was with the observations. Because it's easier. Because where the weak wind set in, that was also where H-alpha as a diagnostic becomes completely insensitive. Below 10 to the minus 7 solar mass per year, you cannot trust H-alpha mass oscillates. So you have to go to the UV. So you change your diagnostic. So maybe the problem is with the diagnostics. But I don't think that anymore. I actually think that you have something similar going on as the bistability jump. We have now done dynamically consistent modeling, and we can actually, below a certain luminosity, so it's not actually, it's actually a temperature. So the empirical people say it's below a luminosity of 5.2, but that actually corresponds to an effective temperature. And it's actually that for the hotter stars, that should be driven by iron 5. The iron 5 opacity is already gone, and the iron 4 isn't important enough yet. So you have a lack of driving below the sonic point. And that's why it's very hard to drive a wind there.
I also read about that maybe these winds from these stars are in sort of a hot phase, and that's why that renders them invisible to traditional mass loss.
That is another possibility, yeah.
Quick question.
Maybe it's just a comment. I mean, you said that the mass loss is depending on metallicity, but I think it's also depending on whether it's on its in composition, whether it's carbon or oxygen rich.
Not for hot stars.
Not
anymore. People thought that.
Huh? Yeah.
And therefore, people thought that Wolfrier stars had such strong winds because of the carbon that is made by the star. Self-enrichment that causes a metal-driven wind. But that's not right.
Okay.
Because iron has millions of lines, so it's actually the host galaxy metallicity, just the iron content, the amount of iron you start off with, that sets the mass loss rate. And the star can do whatever they want, but it's not going to do much to the mass loss rate. It might do something to the terminal velocity, though.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Well, to finish setting up, I have a question. You mentioned that line-driven instability can reproduce the clamping. Do you have the size? Can you reproduce the sizes of the clamping and the clamping?
No one knows the sizes of the clumps.
Okay, but that's the biggest problem, right? You can produce instabilities that create clumps, but you don't know the sizes at all.
Well, there are lots of problems, but yeah, I mean, to do this correctly, you need 3D hydrodynamics. Now, there are people who have done 3D hydrodynamics, but they have made very simple approximations for the line acceleration in terms of the CAK parameterization, which doesn't quite work. So some people do the radiative acceleration very accurately, but look in 1D and stationary, and others look at 3D hydrodynamically, but a very simple radiative acceleration. Before we can combine it all, I think it's still quite far away from there.
Eva, may I continue on your question?
Yes.
How long can these clumps survive? I mean, I have seen theoretical simulations trying to simulate clumps, and they just disappear in 10, 20 years. So what might then be the physical cause for clumps not dissipating?
I think they just move with the wind. I don't see any particular reason why they should.
They
probably, in the adiabatic expansion, they might disappear. And indeed, in some of the Owoki models, you see that the clumping is maximum near the surface, and then they become... then becomes weaker. Is that what you're referring to?
Okay, I think we can continue the discussion over coffee. Let's thank Yorick.
The clumps
again.
You see further out in nebula might begin something completely different.
Yorick, you have to go.
Yeah.
Thank you.